Welcome to episode 36 of the Writing Africa podcast. I'm your host, James Morua. Today we'll be recapping March 2024, and we have an interview at the end of this with Carol Boyce Davis, the legendary academic. Some housekeeping. Remember that you can support the work we do archiving African and Black literature via PayPal, mobile money, or Patreon, starting at $3 a month. You can get information about how to support us at writingafrican.com/donate. First, we have to say goodbye. This month of March, we said goodbye to Kenyan publisher Henry Chakava, who died at age 77 on March 8th. Chakava was a University of Nairobi graduate. He was the managing director of Heinemann Books, you know, which was famous for the African Writer series. He was famous, he was a managing editor of Heinemann in Kenya, and that transitioned into East African educational publishers. This publisher published some of the biggest names in African letters that have ever existed, from Gogi and everybody else to now. We say rest in peace, Mr. Chakava, and to his family and friends, we say condolences. We have to chat about how African writers are responding to world events. And one of the biggest events on the world stage today is in Palestine. Israel is currently trying to blow away everybody in Gaza, and African writers have not been left behind. Zukiswa Vanner, the South African writer, returned her Goethe Medal to the German embassy in Nairobi earlier in the month. She was the first African woman to win this award, which was handed out by the German government. For cooperation, you know, for an individual and their corporate work in the cultural space. She said that she had to give back the award because the German government was complicit in the genocide, being the second largest supplier of weapons to the Israeli regime. The Pen World Voices Festival, which is happening in May, there are several withdrawals from writers because they believe that Pen America is also not doing enough for the Palestinian people. Some of the people who will be drawn, you know, like Maza Mengistu, Ethiopian American, shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and, you know, novelist extraordinaire, Michelle Alexander, Naomi Klein, and other writers. African writers have not just been sitting around wondering what's happening. They have been using their voice and platform to try and, you know, shine a light on, you know, the crises that have been happening. I would chat a bit about the awards that have been won this month. I mean, it's been a, you know, there's been a rich harvest this month. If I was going to talk about every single award that an African writer, and by African writer, it's, you know, African writer in Africa or in the diaspora, and that means includes Caribbean, you know, Europe. So if I was to talk about every single African writer who was either nominated for a prize, either shortlisted or longlisted and won, this podcast will be 3 hours long. So I'm just going to do the winners. Yes, I just know there were many, many people who are nominated for awards across the world. So the winners: Tawanda Mulalu, Botswana born, now based in the USA. His poetry collection has just been announced the winner of the African Poetry Book Fund's Glenn Alisha Prize for Poetry. This prize is specifically for African writers, and it's a poetry prize. Congratulations, Tawanda. Eric Shakur. Eric Shakur is an Egyptian-Canadian. And he, earlier in the week, he won the Prix de Cinq Continents de la Francophonie. He was given the award in Paris. The Prix de Cinq Continents de la Francophonie is an award of the Francophonie, you know, the French conglomerate. It's for 5 continents that have French as a constituent language. And then, you know, they get into this thing and everybody who, and one person wins the award. This year it went to Eric Shakur. Khalid from Morocco actually got a special mention, but the winner was Eric Shakur. In Paris, we're doing a lot of Paris today. I don't know. The way that the festival and award circuit happens is that you follow where the things are happening. And clearly this month a lot happened in Paris. There was a Grand Prix Littéraire d'Afrique Noire, which was given to Debakana Mankensi for his novel Psychanalyse de Brazzaville, Psychoanalyse of Brazzaville. Yeah, this award is for French writing, just like the Prédisson. And then the Prix Koroma, which is basically handed out in honor of Amadou Koroma, who was a legendary African writer. That was handed out in Geneva at Geneva Book Fair, and that went to Bessora for her book Vul Ancestre. We're going across to the US, to USA. The US National Book Critics Awards was also handed out this month of March. And yes, we had two people who won. Safia Sinclair, the Jamaican, for her memoir, How to Say Babylon, and Johnny Steinberg for his biography, William Nelson, Portrait of a Marriage. Yes, it's a portrait of the marriage of Willie and Nelson Mandela. We're going to stick with the USA a bit. US, the NAACP Image Awards. And in those awards, they hand out awards to all the arts, all of them. There were many winners. They hand out awards in, theater, music, cinema, literary arts. And in the literary arts, we had Elizabeth Acevedo, Carida L. Brown, Charlie Palmer, Crystal Zara Pia, Dr. Tanisha C. Ford, Evie Shockley, Alima Omotoni, Karan Betancourt. There are several other winners, but these are the ones who we want to focus on. Oh, yeah, we're in the Americas. We might as well go to the Guyana Prize for Literature. That's for the best writing in the Guyana, or Guyana, which is, in the American, in the American continent. And the biggest winners were Michael Jordan, not to be associated with the basketball legend. Michael Jordan is his own thing. Ethan G.H. Adams, Ian MacDonald, Renéka Anand, Harold Bascom, and Samir Mohammed. In Belgium, there's something called the Royal Academy of French Language and Literature, or I'm going to mess it up, but I'll try. Académie Royale de Langue et de Littérature Française de Belgique. That's basically the Academy of Language and Literature. They have the Nobel Prize, the Grand Prix de Romaine. That was won by an African living in Belgium called Lisette Lombe. Lisette Lombe. Her novel about this award. It's only fair that we wrap up on the continent in South Africa. There is something called the South African Humanities and Social Sciences Award, and it's handed, across the academia, the humanities. And there were several winners in several categories, and these included Sabata Mpo Moukai. He's a serial winner, man. He was working with Brian William. There was Ashwin Desai and Ghulam Vehad, Moses Seletisha, Joel Kabrita, Ashti Jugath, Joan Hinchens, and Karin M. Schreck, Pieter Odendaal, and Craig Higginson. Congratulations to all the people who won in those awards. One of the things I've tried to do this month on the Writing Africa website, which is writingafrica.com, every Thursday at 2 p.m., I've been trying to highlight some of the books that have come out recently. So it's new books, but it's also books that you may not have heard about, because the website is written principal. It's written in English, and we are really on top with the English book in the English universe. But sometimes there are books which, we miss, maybe in the Francophonie side of things, or the Arab side of things, on the Lusophone side of things. So sometimes you have a book which came out a bit earlier, not as recently, but you need to know about this book. So it's a, book digest. And this month we told you about new books, or books that you need to check out, from Mokokodi Dingalo, Kosi Efui, Chukwuebuka Ibe, Rimgafa, Scholastic Mukasonga is one of the most prolific writers from Africa working today. Scholar V. Akinyi, Nkateko Masingwa, Michael Donko, Ines Engo, Shafinaz Hassim, Alisa Cole, Harry Rabari, Beata Umbiei Mayres, Maurice Ruffin, Shobhnam Khan, and Pelu Awafoso. So that's about 16 writers. We try and give you like four every week for our book digest. So if you're on the website, please subscribe. There's a little subscribe thing so you can know what's happening. Every Thursday, there'll be four books for you to check out. They're in different languages. So if you only speak English, tough luck. There'll be books in English, there'll be in French, there'll be Kiswahili, there'll be in Portuguese. Let's talk about some of the festivals that happened in March. I will start in Rwanda, where we had the Rencontre Internationale de Livres Francophone du Rwanda. And that was in Kigali, March 6 to 8. And of course, you know, Rwandese, French is a main language in Rwanda for many years. Trying to change it to English, but it's still French, which is still the major language. So a lot of the people who are in the French writing part of the continent landed in Kigali to talk about their books. Then on March 10th, we had the Johannesburg Festival of Women Writers in Johannesburg, South Africa. And Margaret Busby headlined that event. There were many other writers, but Margaret Busby was the headliner. Then there was the Nairobi Comic Fest. We like comics. We believe that comics belong in the African literary community. And the Nairobi Comic Fest was hosted at Alliance Française Nairobi. And it was the first time they hosted it, and there were several writers who, you know, showcased their work. There was an exhibition of African comics, and there was an exhibition of different stuff. I believe right now, as we speak, a lot of those things are still visible if you go to Alliance Française Nairobi. And of course, you know, Time of the Writer was hosted in Durban, South Africa. If you follow the website writingafrica.com or the product Writing Africa, you know that I always talk about this festival. If you ever are in Durban in March, you want to check out Writing Africa, the Time of the Writer Festival. They hosted many of the best writers working today. From all indications, you know, Facebook, Twitter, and talking to the people who were there, it was an amazing festival. And then the last of the festivals that happened in March that we covered was Salon du Livre Africain de Paris. So it's this event that happens in Paris, and it's this room, and now they hold events, and of course they also have a you know an award ceremony which I mentioned earlier, which was won by Dibakana Mankesi. It's turning out to be a real thing. It's only like a couple of years old, and it's gonna be like a big thing. If you the way I follow these festivals, this is gonna be a very important festival for people who write in French specifically, or trying to sell books written in French. Looking forward to April, there will be a couple of festivals. There'll be many, but the ones I wanna talk about, one of them outside of the continent is the NGC Bocas Lit Fest Festival in Trinidad and Tobago's Port of Spain, April 25th and to 28th. So if you happen to be in Trinidad and Tobago's Port of Spain, Port of Spain is the capital of Trinidad and Tobago. You need to check this festival out. And on the continent, in Guinea Conakry, there'll be the 72 Heures de Livre, 72 Hours of the Book. It'll be hosted on the 23rd to 25th, which is, you know, which is well booked. Day, that period is a well-booked day. So that one you need to check out. So if you're if you're in Conakry, you have 72 Heures de Livre. If you're in Trinidad, you have the NGC Bocas Lit Fest. In today's interview, we chat with Trinidad-born USA-based academic Carol Boyce Davis. On the sidelines of her Nairobi tour, she went to a couple of universities. She did a book event at the legendary Cheche Books, and then she attended the Safal Cornell Kiswahili Prize, which is the biggest prize for an indigenous language in Africa. This is for Kiswahili. We chatted at the Norfolk Hotel in Nairobi. So if you hear birds chirping and you hear some really nice sounds, don't worry, it was collected by the recording device, which is my cell phone. Enjoy. So, I mean, first of all, I want to know, what are you doing in Kenya?
I'm in Kenya for the Safal Prize for real, as I'm on the board that prize, drafted by my colleague at Cornell University, Mukoma Wangugi. 2 years ago, I thought when I heard it announced in Tanzania and I had never been there, I said, you know, actually, I'm on sabbatical leave, I can go. And I went, and it was really good and heartening to see what the prize tries to do, and also to meet some of the writers. For example, I went into downtown Da with one of the communities with a guy friend I met there, an Indian guy, who was just showing me around. And then one of the vendors selling by the street waved at me and said, "Oh, I saw you, you know, last night I was at the prize. I'm one of the winners." And it blew my mind. This was a guy selling headscarves and stuff. And I just began to think of how impactful something like a prize like that can be, because I gather they give them not just money, but sometimes the equivalent in products that they can use for building a home or something. So I felt, you know, it's the kind of thing I would really want to secure and make sure that it continues into the future and help in any way that I can. So then this year it's in Kenya, and I've never really been to Kenya. So that's the other reason why I'm here. Like, really, how could I not have been to Kenya? Because, and I think the easy explanation is that many of us in the Americas have more direct cultural connections, we think, with West Africa, whether it's Ghana or whether it's Nigeria, you know, spiritually and culturally and so on. But see, the East Coast is really on the other side, although there have been formidable connections over the years. So that's really no excuse. So those are the two main reasons why I'm here, really trying to fill back in that part of my knowledge gap as far as this part of the world is concerned.
Can we talk a bit about the Safal? I mean, I know that Cornell has been tied to the prize for the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it so? Why do you think it's so important for Cornell specifically to be associated with such a prize?
I think the ingenuity of in Mukoma, for real, it's not really Cornell, is Mukoma's generativeness in really pursuing this, wanting to create his own legacy that is different from his father's, but also doing something as fundamentally important in a practical way. And then using the institutions where we are and where we get paid and where we can access some of their resources that they have to do these kinds of collaborations. So I think it's more that. So we're not going to give the university that much credit. We'll give ourselves the work. We'll give ourselves the credit for doing this.
Yeah, but is Cornell benefiting anything from this?
They do benefit, but you know, these huge institutions are like mega countries, if you will. Some of them have resources bigger than many Caribbean countries, and I'm sure some African countries. So they benefit just by being able, when they're listing items, to say, well, yes, we have done this little thing in Africa. Because they also, they have environmental studies programs which come here, they have medical programs and so on. So for them, as you know, with these institutions, the accountability is more at the end of the year of accounting what they've done to be able to check that box, say yes, they've done it. And this is, I think, the way that most of these institutions work. It's not like a Howard where I am now. I'm at Howard University, and Howard University has a long, long history of really deliberate African, Pan-African and African diaspora contacts and have a commitment consistently to keeping these connections alive. In fact, when I was coming here, I told the dean that I was going to Kenya for a week, and I told him why, and his response in his email was, "I'm really happy about that because we need to keep building these kinds of connections." Totally different from what I would have heard at Cornell. They'd be like, "Wow, okay."
Okay, so maybe we expect something from Howard as well.
We would try, for sure.
Okay.
Howard is not as resourced, as you can imagine,
yes,
as those other major Ivy League institutions. But what they would provide is, of course, the name and the connections and the possibilities for doing exchanges or elaborative kinds of projects.
So, I mean, you've not just come from Safal. You've been doing a little tour of the university. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Right, again, since I was coming here, Mukoma talked to the bookshop, and he said this would be a good time possibly to do a book event at Cheche Books. And he was surprised when he talked to the director of the bookshop that she said, "Wow, one of her books is a pretty big bestseller here." And that's the Claudia Jones Left of Karl Marx book. So she wanted to know if I could do something in the bookshop, and I said, sure. So in fact, what ended up happening was that around my visit, and since I was going to be here a whole week, he kept adding things that I could do. So going to Moranga was one of the nicest experiences we had because we were able to talk in a big auditorium to a huge slice of the student population, and then for them to give responses and questions. That was really lovely. So I was really pleased to also see those two universities beyond their campuses.
So Muranga and Kenyatta.
And Kenyatta University. So we did those two. We didn't do the University of Nairobi. We did those two. But the other aspect of going to Muranga that was lovely was a lovely opportunity to also see outside of the city what other communities exist and what other areas of the country, limited in a certain way, but in the Nairobi periphery, look like or could be like.
Okay, and what do they look like?
They look like Caribbean countries. They look like people struggling, like markets on the road. I love the fact that you had so many fruit vendors selling so much beautiful fruit. And the reason why that is always so striking when you see it is because whenever in the West they portray Africa, it's always portrayed in terms of lack. So you never see them showing the bounty of the land in a certain way, so that you could see such beautiful mangoes and bananas and pineapples looking all gorgeous and rich and all of that. So along the road, that for me was one of the most inviting things to look at. And of course, people, right? These are my people. So to see my people as they move around the road and go from place to place, work and do whatever they need to do is also heartwarming.
No, that's good. I mean, I was following your Instagram feed. It's actually really nice. Now, I mean, like you did an event at Churchill last night. I mean, it was a full house. Were you surprised?
Yes, I was.
How was that?
But you know, we're living on the whole other side of the world, and you don't know what you know. We work, right? This is what I was saying to one of the young people I was talking to. We do the work, and then you hope it reaches somewhere, and you do it with that kind of joy of discovery that you do with doing good research. So then to realize that some of the things you've done has a certain kind of impact, and that people want to hear more and all of that is just so lovely to know. It gives you a feeling of really completion in a way that what you try to do as a scholar has a certain kind of viability in a different kind of context.
Your 1994 book, Black Women's Writing and Expanding the Discourse, after the fact and even during the event, you spoke about some of the challenges when you're producing this work. You said that you know the men were saying there's no specific women thinking. Would you like to chat a bit about that?
Yeah, I got my degree at the University of Ibadan, Nigeria, in African literature, and doing that itself was already expanding my horizons in terms of knowledge of African literatures and being able to be on the continent itself. The reason why I say that, many people study and read it, but they're reading it from a distance. So being able to be on the continent itself and engage with what some of the textual meanings are was part of the richness that I felt that I gained by doing that. But at the same time, almost every one of the traditions we work in, once you have accomplished a certain level of understanding of it, you begin to see where the gaps are. And clearly, one of the gaps was in the absence of women. So the first book we did was an edited collection on, not on women's writing, but on the representations of women in African literature. And we discovered from the scholars who began to look at that work that there tended to be very few representations. Either tended to be mothers. Almost all the women you tended to see were mothers. Or we laughed because in the Gugi case, prostitutes, virgins. So you didn't really see self-empowered women in a lot of the literature. And then the tendency, particularly from the Negritude generation on, was to valorize those mothers and make them, you know, motherhood became Mother Africa and all the romanticized meanings of that. So until you have women's writing, where you begin to have people like Buchi Emechetus in The Joys of Motherhood, really challenging the meaning of that motherhood and saying it can be joy and also pain. It's not automatically just a sort of romanticized logic of the Mother Africa. So we began to have a whole different set of conversations when we began to look at women's writing, what the women had been saying, and then even going back to older writers from prior to that period who were making a different kind of critique of the experiences of African women as it relates to how they were navigating the pre-colonial, the post-colonial space, and what modern Africa was doing at that time as far as their lives are concerned. You know, that boundary between stepping out of colonialism into a sort of independent modern Africa, then what were the definitions and meanings? And one of the fascinating things that I found in my most recent work, Black Women's Rights, Leadership and the Circularities of Power, is that almost all of those political movements, whether it's in Nkrumah, whether any of secretary. They depended on women's activism. Many of the movements were full-bodied by women who were doing all of the activist work. However, when these countries became independent and they began apportioning ministries and who would do what, they tended to remove women from the picture. So it's an ongoing kind of discussion. You can elevate it in any kind of way you want to look at it. So the first collection was that book, Studies of Women in African Literature. And yes, at that point, many of the male African colleagues who were writing about African writing, but from the male perspective, began saying things like there's no need to study women because African women are already free and we don't, you know, the common critiques you already heard or you can still hear, right? So the pressure to do it was always there, but we were very resistant and we were very, we have a generation that pushed the boundaries and we feel happy that that has led to there being fields of study where people, young scholars are able now to, as some of them said last night, to use that work to sort of justify doing other kinds of studies that relate to those fields.
I mean, in Kenya, so you did a tribute to Michelle Mugo.
Yeah.
I mean, how important was she?
Significant. And I recently found, when I was in grad school in Nigeria, there was a journal called Africa Woman, and I bought it, you know, as you buy these magazines. Sadly, it no longer exists. It was published out of London, I believe. But in it, there was an interview with Michelle. And they were asking her a number of questions about how she saw herself and how she saw it, what she was doing. And in fact, the introductory caption to it defined her as the outspoken intellectual Michelle Mugu. And so she was already branded as somebody who was fearlessly outspoken. So the thing about Michelle that I always thought was so lovely was that she used to make really amazing pronouncements and criticisms, but she always did it with such a gracious smile and, you know, so lovely in how she would frame it and all of that. But at the same time, she was really pushing back really hard at how women were represented. So Michelle for us then was like a big sister who like showed you how to be, how to dress, how to be in the world, how you can confront those demons that are still out there and still be yourself, still be beautiful and still carry forward. That's Michelle. And it was funny because we lived about an hour away. But if each of the times that something bad would happen, we would be communicating via email, like when Trump won the presidency. And we were like, what did we do? You know, like I remember texting her or emailing her saying, Michelle, how, you know, this is, we didn't really, when we came to the United States as students and people coming to work, we didn't really imagine that this would be the kind of turn of conditions that one would experience. In other words, she and I and many others came into the U.S. Academy at a point when it was opening up for black people's experience, you know, all the universities were hiring people and you had a whole different kind of energy around participating in the U.S. So suddenly we have this sort of turning back into like a really horribly anti-democratic sort of
fascist-y.
Yeah, neo-fascist for sure. Kinds of experience. So we were both saying we didn't really bargain on this when we, you know, entered the U.S. as people who are going to be living and working here and all of that. And you know, many of us, like, including me, we didn't. And many of us didn't really plan that this was going to be where you would live forever. But once you're in a place working and then you have children and the children are going to school and you send, you know, the whole question of undoing all of that takes a whole other kind of thing. In terms of a whole other set of decisions. So many people end up staying where they are, developing their careers. And some, of course, go back home, and willfully so.
I really enjoyed the conversation with Dr. Joyce Nyairu. There was a question about Trinidad and Tobago, you know, like where a lot of our most outspoken people, some of the strongest voices come from that country. Why is that?
Right. I was trying, you know, I'm always asked that question, and I didn't say this in the same way last night, but if you're very nationalistic, you would want, as many people are, they would want to say, well, we have the most whatever, we are the best whatever. But I tend to look at the whatever conditions created it. And I think in some ways, a kind of energy of resistance was built into the fabric of Trinidad and Tobago. And you see it, as I said, expressed in Carnival and so on. But you also see it in the intellectual responses and in the, and, you know, the boldness to decide that you're going to really be declarative about yourself, your existence, and so on. So I think historically we've always had that. There are a lot of stories of Africans who came through enslavement, and there's one in Trinidad who spent the first years that he was there just trying to figure out how to get back. You know, and of course he never could, but he was always, that was his passion. And one of them actually was somebody who would have been African royalty, Jaja Opobo, his name is. And when I was growing up, there were always people who would, when they meet somebody who was being like an upstart, they would say, this person thinks he's Jaja Opobo. And it's only when you got older, you realized that they were talking about this person who was spending his time after having been royalty and having been captured as an enslaved person, now trying to figure out how to resist, how to get back, how to push back against these. So I think according to the people who studied it, it's a sort of confluence of things. It's that history of resistance. It's that forceful migration and then trying to figure out a way out of it. It's the intellectual responses, I would say, to discrimination and oppression and how to push back against that. And it's a cultural space where one feels free enough not to, geographically free enough not to accept the same oppressive conditions that existed in other places. So I think that's probably one of the reasons. And I'm sure I'm not, you know, usually once I have that question, I think of more things afterwards.
No, it's okay. Yeah. You actually trained Yvonne,
mm-hmm.
and you were raised, and then you moved to the U.S., and mm-hmm. but you also go back to Trinidad. I think somebody yesterday said they'd never met a Caribbean writer.
I was amazed by that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And a lot of us know the older ones. Would you like to share some of the younger scholars and writers that we need to be looking out from, not just from Trinidad, but from the Caribbean area?
Oh, wow. Well, I don't know if you've read the Haitian writers, Edwidge Lantica.
Yeah.
She's a really interesting writer who has done amazing range of novels, mostly, and also some short reflective pieces on, you know, the whole question of migration and the forces that sort of propelled one to that migration. So I would, you know, one sees a couple of different trajectories, right? So you would see in the Haitian writers a kind of way of trying to understand why is it, after having done all of that preliminary work to be liberated, that Haiti still ends up being as its opposition. And as a result of that, the easy answer is, of course, that Haiti is always being punished for having been the first country to liberate itself. But there are a lot of other explanations as well that talk about the fact that you also have a kind of generation of male leaders who ended up trying to reproduce some of the same oppressive practices that they fought. And that doesn't come up that much. So I think in all our discussions, and women, I think, are better doing it, they look at both things. You know, is it the West only, or is it also some other kinds of gendered assumptions around masculinity and leadership and toxicity of violence that sometimes are carried along into other generations that may be operating like that? So I would say Edwidge Lantica, and around there, a whole range of writers. Some of my students are doing theses on some of these people. Miriam Chansey, another writer, has been writing a lot about current events like the earthquake and what it means and trying to understand some of these developments through the eyes of the various characters and populations that still exist. And then if you move through to Jamaica, you have a whole other group of writers doing similar kinds of analyses, particularly around questions of women and the body, and Trinidad for sure. There's a couple of things that happen in Jamaica that really make the writing have that kind of promise, and that is a festival called Calabash, which is held every year, and it was only stopped during COVID when people couldn't really go and travel, but now it's started again. And then in Trinidad, there's a prize called the Bocas Literary Prize, and that sort of generates a whole new generation of writers. So each time you look, you see more and more of these writers coming forward, and there's one of them, the person who won the prize recently, and I forgot her last name, but the book is called When We Were Birds. It is a beautiful
account. Diana Lloyd.
Yes, right.
Mm.
She has an African last name as well.
Yeah.
Dafu or something.
Banwo,
that one. I love her work. Mm. And I find her, when I read it and listened to it also on Audible. I was just so amazed because she was able to really get at the sort of mythology that comes with Caribbean experience, the grandmother stories, you know, the cemetery, the Rastafari character, and how he encountered her, and relationship to death as well in cemetery. Actually, Joyce Nayarro might be interested in that book for that reason.
She should be.
She should be.
Yeah. I mean, like, of course, I must ask you, because the project I do is for all black writers. You've spoken about Caribbean. What about African continental writers? Have you experienced any of them?
Yeah. I recently started reading A Whole New Generation, and I mentioned Violet Bulawayo, but that's easy because she was a student in one of my classes, Black Feminist Theories class, at one point. So, Violet Bulawayo, and she has a really interesting book, a new book called Glory, which was actually nominated, I think, for the book.
The book, it's really good.
Yeah. I found that fascinating, the way she was able to use the George Orwellian kind of structures to give animal characteristics to a lot of people. And that really hard critique of the First Lady, which I also have. I share that critique. The whole sort of First Lady syndrome. The First Lady who wants to be the leader, for real. So I really love her work. And of course, her first book was, I still use parts of it in lectures, where she talks about why did people leave. You know, look at them, look at how they're leaving, you know, knowing that they won't be accepted when they get there, but they're leaving anyway. So she's talking about a particular period when a number of Africans were really trying, and still are in different places, trying to get there by any means necessary. So I'm gradually reading more and more and more of these writers. And, of course, I read, one of my other students was working on Jennifer
Makumbi,
right. So I've been reading her work as well, especially The First Woman.
From Manchester.
Yeah, I've read Manchester, but I mean, I've read that story, that collection of stories, but I also need to read Kintu. I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, it's really good.